91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. You may find it odd just how prevalent the military is in daily life. No, not in budget outlays or martial law, but in our daily foods. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. It's not popular now, but instant coffee was first given to soldiers. The forerunner of the TV dinner was made for warfare, as was the granola bar. Supermarket breads last longer because troops needed it to. Ditto with processed meats. Without foods to go, the Roman Empire would have fizzled. But military research in hand with corporate giants have much greater influence on our diet than we think. In minutes, we speak with the author of Combat Ready Kitchens, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way We Eat. Holy Cheese Whiz. First, it's the news.
Welcome back to Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. I'm Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. This hour, we get a taste of how foods developed for use by the military have influenced what's found in supermarkets, the extent of collaboration between the U.S. military and mega corporate entities is surprising.
We'll learn more from the author of a new book called Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. She's Anastasia Marx de Salcedo. I got that pronounced right, I think. And she joins us from Watertown, Massachusetts. Welcome to Topical Currents, Anastasia.
Thank you very much for having me, Joe and Bonnie.
Oh, great to have you with us.
And let me add in, because I speak Spanish, Buenas tardes, Miami.
Okay. Yes. Well, your book was such a revelation. I don't think many of us connect our love of processed foods with the U.S. military. How did you make that connection?
Well, it was something that came to me when I was preparing lunches for my children, which I do a lot of. And one day, as I was assembling their sandwiches, I was sort of feeling a little grouchy because I already added in a fair number of sort of what I considered unhealthy items, a energy bar, and I had little cheesy snack crackers that they love. And so the sandwich was sort of my idea of the healthy part of my lunch. And then all of a sudden I started thinking, and I was like, gee, this, you know, the packaged deli meat that I'm pulling out of my refrigerator and this bread that's been sitting inside my bread box, they've been sitting there for a long time. They're not particularly healthy, and you know, I wonder really how is that they last so long. And so I ended up, I'm a food writer, and I was at the time collaborating with a PBS blog, and I said, well, you know, I'm going to write something about the ingredients in a sandwich. And so, you know, I went and I researched each ingredient, and I got very deeply into the food science. And I found at the origins of two of those, the packaged deli meat and the supermarket bread, this reference to this obscure U.S. Army base, the Natick Soldier System Center. And I said to myself, whoa, that's really strange that here I am writing a piece about a sandwich and two of the ingredients have been influenced by the Army. So I went and started to do more research on what the Natick Center was. And from that came the book.
So if you make a school lunch for your kid, what are the chances of including some form of military-inspired food?
I want to say 100%.
100, yeah.
Because a lot of, I mean, and when you think about it, it makes sense because some of the values that the Army is looking for in creating combat rations are similar to the values we look for in our children's lunches. And those are, the Army looks for things that are imperishable, durable, affordable, and palatable. And we look for something a little bit similar in our lunches. So there is that relationship. But pretty much every item in your lunchbox, if you do rely on the packaged foods may have a military influence, from the bread, cheese, deli meat in the sandwich, the cheesy crackers, the energy bar, and the plastic packaging you may use for the sandwich, and including if you include a juice box in the lunch.
Can I ask? I'm sorry.
It's a pretty extreme situation.
I just wanted to ask how you were able to gain access to a U.S. Army Natick Soldier Research Development Engineering Center that no one's even heard of, that forms the bedrock of the American diet. How did you get in there?
Well, the short answer is I asked, and they were actually pretty welcoming. I made a couple of site visits, and that they set up many interviews with staff, and they were helpful in getting me connected to other resources. There were some areas where doing research on a U.S. Army base had a chilling effect, however, and the first were in the documents. So, for instance, the primary document that I used in guiding my research were notes from the Oversight Committee for Army Food Research. Those are classified for 25 years. So my research, at least using those, ended in, I think it was 1987.
Okay.
And then information about partnerships between corporations and the military is classified for 5 years. So that was one way. The other way was that although the Natick Center itself was extremely cooperative, I did find that there being the Army had a chilling effect on their current collaborators and on observers in the industry and in the food science media. So at a certain point, I was compiling lists of my interview subjects versus the people who had declined, and those lists were running neck and neck. And at the end, I would say that most of the people I interviewed were actually retirees or not American citizens.
Interesting.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Our military fathers had the sea ration. Today it's the meals ready to eat. What varieties are there? And you tasted some. Were they very palatable?
Well, the sea rations, we can all kind of taste if we go to the supermarket and look at some of those old canned goods like the Chef Boyardee's and the Dinty Moore beef stews. Those are very similar to what the sea ration was.
My Marine father used to talk about the chipped beef on toast, which had a little bit different moniker also.
Yeah, and the chipped beef on toast and the Vienna sausages, those are all outgrowths of the sea ration. The MREs, our menus that I think there are between 18 and 24 menus that change yearly, and the Army is constantly testing new menus and adding in the ones that soldiers like and taking out the ones that they don't like. I had the opportunity while I was there to test the hamburger. My hamburger was probably a couple years old. And, let's say, I think it was edible. That's about as much as I'll say.
Getting back to when you said most of the people you talked to were retired or living abroad that were able to talk to you, what conclusions did you draw from that?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
When you said that most of the people who would talk to you in either the industry or academia were either retired or living abroad?
Mm-hmm.
What did you draw any conclusions from that?
Well, you know, I have to be very careful about it because on the one hand, I was looking at the history of military influence, so I was probably talking to some older people. But I did find that when I reached out to some of the current collaborators, sometimes they just ignored me. Industry pretty much routinely ignored me. So I did feel that my feed was, maybe we don't want to come out being associated too closely with the military. So,
Would you describe the Natick Center for us? Like, take us there.
Sure thing. The Natick Center is about 15 minutes west of Boston in a suburban town. It occupies a 78-acre campus next to a lovely lake and surrounded by woods. You drive up there, and there's a gatehouse and barriers and a lot of uniformed men and women, and you have to go through sort of a checkpoint. And then spread across the campus are probably 8, 10 large buildings, and those actually house the Combat Feeding Directorate, which is what I wrote about, is just one of the research programs at the Natick Center. So there are probably between 8 and 12 other programs, and they are all dedicated to doing research on things that serve the individual soldier's needs. So that would be tents, textiles, body armor, airdrop equipment, and, of course, the rations. The Combat Feeding Directorate is sort of at the back of the facility, and it has this kind of funky striped building, and it's surrounded by these old rusting kitchen equipment, which is kind of comical. And then when you go in, there's a little area off to the left with lots of displays of the things they've created over the years, and off to the right there's a huge food lab where they are creating and tweaking the next year's or two or 3 years hence rations. They also have a polymer center, which is to create the packaging. They have equipment that is designed to test the ruggedness of the ration, and they do things like dropping it and squeezing it and jiggling it, and they all end putting it in chambers at very high temperature. Oh, and finally, there's one more thing which is interesting, which is they have a sensory evaluation lab, which is where people come in and test the rations by eating them, and I get a chance to do that. And they have a whole very elaborate system of measuring, you know, how tasty the foods are. And in fact, that's one of the important influences that has come from the military to the food industry, which is they pretty much developed a whole system of how to evaluate consumer appeal, taste appeal.
We're speaking with Anastasia Marx de Salcedo. She's a food writer, and her book is entitled Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. On today's Topical Currents, a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back with Anastasia Marx de Salcedo. We're talking about her book, Combat Ready Kitchen. And if you'd like to join in, you can give us a call at 1-800-743-9576. Also, email, that's radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. Anastasia, I was interested to find out that the ubiquitous plastic wraps that we encounter so many times each day, of course, started with the military. And what did they first use it for to keep eatable?
Plastic wrap is something that's very interesting, and that came out of World War II. At that time, there was a tremendous shortage of the natural materials that people use for the things of everyday life. And among other things, the government has started to very important programs. One was to develop synthetic rubber, and the other was to develop synthetic polymers. Polymers are plastics. And the plastics program was charged with kind of replacing so many different items that soldiers needed, everything from shoelace tips to suitcases to bugles to the handles for equipment. And one of the things that it was a classified research program, and it was done in Brooklyn at the Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn. And one of the things they were asked to do was to find new food packaging. And the reason for that was that until World War II, the packaging used for food had been limited to, you know, paper and wax, tin, and then cellophane. Cellophane is actually a natural polymer which is made with cellulose and is not a very, very water resistant. So they had terrible problems with the rations getting soggy and perhaps even molding. So during World War II, this lab was working with Dow Chemical, which had discovered the Saran plastic and created a resin, but they hadn't created a film out of it. And it was sort of behind the scenes figuring out all the difficulties in turning this plastic into a film. So after the war ended, Dow very quickly took out a patent and then rushed to the market with Saran Wrap. And it has, until now, it has earned all the credit for Saran Wrap because, as is very typical with military research, the military has no need to proclaim that it's the inventor. It just wants to get the thing made, and in fact, it would perhaps even prefer that somebody else take the credit. So Dow, I think a fellow named Boyer, who was involved in the project, took the credit for that. But the U.S. Army, behind the scenes, was there working out many of the difficulties in creating this plastic.
Well, that was something interesting that struck me in the book, is that how much value the private sector gets from essentially what's free research from the federal government.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a great arrangement because, in fact, the Combat Feeding Directorate and any Department of Defense federal laboratory, of which there are 80, has a mandate to get the science that and technology that it uses in creating combat rations into our food. The reason for that is that after World War II, the government decided that they never wanted to have to go through the experience of ramping up for this massive international war, and that we would maintain our military and the commercial sector that supports it in readiness, and that's called preparedness. We recognize that word today. The federal laboratories, and there are more other than the Department of Defense, there are actually 700 of these, work on creating the science that gives us a competitive advantage and a military advantage. And as part of their goal to maintain readiness in the commercial sector, they have to disseminate that science and technology. And it's called technology transfer. It's their mission.
Who are
In fact, I have an anecdote about that, which is I was quite surprised to discover that the book had been mentioned with a lot of cheering on what's called the Federal Laboratory Consortium, which is a consortium of these laboratories. And they said, yay, somebody's finally recognizing all the work we've done transferring technology to the food industry.
Who are some of these food giants that are benefiting by this and collaborate with the military? Who are they?
Well, you could pretty much go through sector by sector in the food industry, pick out the biggest names, and they would have collaborated at some point with the military, and that goes way back. Certainly in the meat industry, some of the names have disappeared over time, but Swift,
right.
Armour, Hormel just recently actually got a great freebie from the military in something called high-pressure processing, which it worked on in the early 2000s and then brought to market a new preservative-free line of deli meats, which is based on that technology. Now, you have General Mills, General Foods, Quaker Oats, Pillsbury, Mars Masterson, Best, Sopaco, Unilever. I mean, I could probably go through one of those lists of the top, 20 or 30 biggest food industry companies, and many of them would be have been collaborators with the military.
That's a pretty good deal they have.
Right, because they get, so what they get out of the deal is they get, well, for in terms of investing in science, it's generally not in a company's interest to invest in something that will benefit everybody. They want to come up with something that can be proprietary, so they have a competitive advantage in the marketplace. So the way this works is that the Natick Center invests in some of the big, important questions in food science, the things that I call in the book sort of the backbone of industrial food. You know, how do we achieve shelf life? How do we keep the flavor and texture stable over time? That sort of thing. They put that out there either through publications, through conferences, through consultations, and very importantly, through some of the collaborations with industry and academia. And so then the large food companies just take that and say, great, you know, now we're going to tweak some flavors, we're going to create a variety of different products based on the same concept. But they do sort of the final little bit that is geared to the consumer and getting him or her to buy the product.
I was surprised when you talked about in the book Combat Ready Kitchens about some of the surprising grocery store items that we go to, and I wouldn't think the produce department would have any, but I suppose the pre-washed greens, the lettuce and such, they control the gas inside and also the humidity and prolong its life.
Right, that came, and that actually surprised me, and that came out of work done with Whirlpool in the 1960s in trying to prolong freshness for shipments of, I think it was to start, lettuce and I think a celery to Vietnam. And so that technology, which is called modified atmosphere, was then, had used in the commercial produce industry, and eventually it found its way into individual packages.
You mentioned before this high-pressure processing that you can use instead of using, and it eliminates the need of using preservatives. What is that?
Ooh. Well, high-pressure processing is the equivalent of putting 20 minivans on a penny. It's a tremendous amount of pressure. And what that does is it, and I'm not going to explain how it works scientifically, but it used, the pressure travels through water and into the food. And what it does is it shakes loose the bonds in molecules, and in particular it shakes loose single bonds instead of double bonds. And these single bonds tend to be in the larger molecules, which are things like fats and proteins and carbohydrates. And if there's a bacteria inside the food, it's composed of these things, the lipids and the carbohydrates and the proteins, and it dies. But some of the double bonds are in some of the important molecules like vitamins and flavor and so forth, so it doesn't affect those as much, which is why it's an effective food processing technique.
Is this, by the way, safe? I mean, I realize they're, looking for these most efficacious ways to produce these things and shelf life and, portability and all that, but does anyone check them for safety?
Well, I'm going to... this is an area where I didn't do a tremendous amount of research.
Okay.
I did find that there were not many safety studies for high pressure processing, and it's new. So I think that when it was approved, but actually this is an interesting side story, which is when high pressure processing itself didn't need to be approved by the FDA, but a cousin technique, which is called pressure assisted thermal sterilization, does. and because it can be used on low-acid foods. And the interesting thing was that the Natick Center itself was involved in creating the white paper on which the FDA then based its decision that these new sorts of food sterilization techniques were effective. So, and in part that's because there are not many experts on it, but it, to me, that seemed a little bit alarming.
Yeah.
So how has this high-pressure technique reached consumers yet, or will it?
It has already reached consumers. I mean, it's there in the supermarket.
For example, the
shelf-stable refrigerated guacamole that stays green is high-pressure processed. Some of the fresh fruit beverages, the fresh juices, those are high-pressure processed. Some of them, others are flash pasteurized. There's lines of these preservative-free deli meats and flavor, some sauces and flavorings are also high-pressure processed. So it's really prevalent in the supermarket already.
It seems so incongruous that to get a drug on the market, you know, the FDA makes these companies, I guess, go through years of, you know, safety tests, all sorts of tests for safety and efficacy as well. And yet this high pressure processing doesn't have to go through the FDA at all.
Well, they have to show that it doesn't have a harmful effect. And one of the things that we have to differentiate when we're talking about these safety studies is between, there's studies that show that it does in fact kill bacteria. That's one thing.
Oh, okay.
And then there are the other kinds of studies which are the impact on human health. It is the latter category where there really isn't too much information. There is plenty of information to show that it does, in fact, kill bacteria.
All right. Well, that's the one I was talking about, the impact on human health. But anyway, we're speaking with Anastasia Marx de Salcedo. She's a food writer. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, Salon, Boston Globe, and other publications. And she's a regular contributor to NPR's Public Radio Kitchen. She's written Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. Another short break, and we'll be back. Welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Anastasia Marx de Salcedo, a food writer, and she's written Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. A lot of surprises in the book. If you have a question for Anastasia, did you know that the military had a big influence on what's in our supermarket? You can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio@wlrn.org.
Anastasia, also in the book you talk about that what we see in the usually in the meat area of our supermarkets, which are the heat and serve ready to go meals, such as chicken and sauces and mac and cheese, that came from the military. How so?
Well, there are two ways that it came. The first, of course, are the TV dinners.
And, oh yes.
Yeah, the first TV dinners were actually created for bomber crews and on long flights by an Army contractor, and they froze a bunch of food into a serving tray, and that was the first TV dinner.
And how did they heat them?
And, you know, I don't know how they heated them on the first flights, but soon after that, and probably in relation to that, the Army ended up creating the microwave oven. And that's kind of an interesting story because it came out of the magnetron, which is used for military armaments purposes. But they discovered that they could use these the radiation to heat food as well.
Yeah, it moves the molecules around, but it can't be used on foil. So they must have been heating the TV dinner somehow conventionally, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I think that the first, and I don't know what, I think they were, and I think that may have been an issue, too, on these flights, so.
And getting to the mac and cheese that Joe mentioned, tell us about how they were able to dry cheese. That was quite a process.
Oh, yes, this is a fun story, which is during World War II, and World War II is, I describe it in the book, as the Big Bang, because so much happened there, and it really transformed the food industry, including with this military involvement. And during World War II, because there were so many troops to feed at the maximum 11.6 million, the U.S. Army tried to figure out ways to reduce the volume and the weight of the food that it was shipping overseas. And so one way to do that was to dehydrate it, and it dehydrated things like eggs and, of course, milk, fruit, and vegetables, and it decided it would try to dehydrate cheese. Well, cheese, when you dehydrate it, just kind of turns into dust, but they were not deterred, and they developed a method for dehydrating the cheese, although the other problem with cheese is that it has fat, and that will melt away from the food and create a mess. So they figured out a way to dehydrate it, maintaining the fat by doing it in steps. And then they created these compressed cakes of dehydrated cheese powder and shipped those overseas to army camps. Well, when the war ended, they'd actually had created this small industry of cheese dehydrators, which was centered in Wisconsin, where you have the Wisconsin cheddar. And they needed to have a market. So they looked around, and with a little bit of help from the government, they set their sights on the big food manufacturers. And those food manufacturers quickly began to offer snacks and convenience foods with dehydrated cheese powder, either in it or on it. And the Cheeto would have been one of the first examples of that.
There we go, the Cheeto.
The Cheeto.
Yes. So what would you say are some of the most noteworthy contributions? I mean, Joe mentioned, and you've talked about Saran Wrap and stuff.
Instant coffee.
Yeah. What are some of the ones, what are some of the biggest successes, do you think, and the biggest failures? There must be some failures.
Well, there are. I mean, the first of all, the military has influenced pretty much every department at the supermarket, and you know, as we talked before with Joe, even in the produce department, where you might be surprised to find them, they've had areas where they've made a contribution. The meat department has a tremendous number of influences, from cutting meat off the bone and putting it into boxes for shipping, which happened in the early part of the century, to something called restructured meats, which happened in the 1960s when finally the rest of the world caught up with the idea of this boxed meat, and the Army began to buy boxes of the cheapest cuts and to try and figure out a way to glue those together and come up with something that looked like a more expensive cut. And actually, out of this came some of our favorite fast foods, including the McRib. So that's one area.
Right.
Is anything that's unnaturally boneless, I guess, is suspect as far as that it's been fiddled with?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that question?
Anything that you buy, any sort of meat that you buy that is boneless, like the McRib, that naturally has bones has probably been fiddled with.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it added a lot of value to the meat industry because, at first, they were shipping these carcasses, and the carcasses would be delivered to supermarkets and the stores, and they would be butchered there so that they had to have a professional butcher there, and the customers would come in and ask for the cuts they want. So it offered a tremendous value because suddenly the meat industry could just do the butchering on site. They took everything from the scraps that they could then be utilized for other products such as the bones and fat and the pieces that they couldn't sell, and then they were able to just ship this product. So it added quite a bit. And then later on, of course, it became this whole idea of the structured meat, which was utilizing the cheaper cuts of meat and allowed, again, a reduction in cost and an ability to utilize more of the animal. And that has ended up being, in a certain way, it's led to a cheaper meat bill for consumers. And today, we actually consume 40 more pounds of meat per person than we did in the 1950s. And I think that in large part is due to the fact that we now are consuming a great proportion of these cheap restructured products that come from the military.
I know that SPAM stands for spiced ham, but how was that developed and what's in it?
Well, you know, I did not actually investigate the SPAM because I knew that that was sort of the hallmark product for military. So I don't know too much on its history.
And the Underwood deviled hams and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the deviled ham. I mean, these were all, again, I can say that all of these big meat industry companies were very early collaborators with the military. And so, you know, the SPAM and the would have come out of that collaboration. I think the SPAM from Hormel?
Maybe. I don't know.
And it's still widely used in Hawaiian cuisines.
Yeah, I hear that it's quite, with pineapple, right? It's quite tasty.
Oh, my. You know, I'm just wondering, Anastasia, as we find out more and more about processed foods, it seems like it's pointing to the fact that processed foods are at the least not too good for us, and at the worst, they're pretty bad for us. And I'm just wondering if there's any movement, I mean, for the health of the military and for us, away from processing, because you'd think they'd want to, I mean, maybe there is no other answer, and keeping it portable and long life and
all
that.
What are you going to do in the fields of Afghanistan?
Well, I guess, I don't know. I'm just wondering if they can invent these things, maybe they can invent things that are a little healthier.
Well, I think I think that you have hit on something there, Bonnie, and there's some good news in all of this, which is just like us consumers, the military has become more health conscious about the foods that it feeds soldiers. So, in fact, the high-pressure processing, although it lacks long-term human health studies, that could be promising because it allows the food to be preserved with a minimum of chemical preservatives. On the downside, the Army has also discovered that by far and away the most cost-effective way to feed soldiers is with packaged rations. And the reason for that is that although they may cost more to manufacture, the garrison or the field kitchen costs a lot in terms of, you have to ship in the equipment, you have to set up the equipment, run it, you have to ship in fuel, you have the personnel, it creates a lot of food waste. And so, in fact, they're really considering moving to a system that would reduce or eliminate the hot breakfast and hot lunch and hot dinner and replace it with an all-day grazing items of processed foods. So news is probably not good there.
So there was a little good news, but then came the bad news.
Yeah, well, it's kind of both because, you know, maybe in fact this high-pressure processing is healthier, although I don't think we know yet. But the bad news is that I think the packaged goods are going to be have an even greater role in the future.
Oh, my. Well, we're going to take another short break. We're speaking with Anastasia Marx de Salcedo about her book, Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. And we'll be right back.
And we're back. Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper. And we resume our conversation about the book, Combat Ready Kitchens, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. It's written by Anastasia Marx de Salcedo, and she's joining us now from Watertown, Massachusetts. If you'd like to join in, we have a little bit of time and a few lines open, 1-800-743-9576, or email That's quicker, radio@wlrn.org. Anastasia, of course, humans have been warring from the beginning. And also then as armies began to grow, they had to be fed. But I suppose in the book I learned that really the Roman legions were the ones who finally put it all together. What did the Roman soldier eat, and how were they able to go from Rome all the way up to Great Britain?
The Roman legionnaire was fueled by pork, by some things that people find very tasty.
The pork traveled with them?
Prosciutto and sausage, yes, they did, and because the pork, those are preserved items.
We have an emailer. Laura says, with this high-pressure treatment available and in use, how do you account for the periodic outbreaks of salmonella causing sickness and sometimes death in large populations in the U.S.? I don't know if you know the answer to that, Anastasia.
I'm not sure that they would be connected to the high-pressure processing.
Right.
But I would just say in general, one of the issues with our food system is that we have so many sources of the food item, and then they, of course, get mixed in the food processing facility. And then so that really creates a much higher risk. So if you compare it to the olden days, like when you bought your own chicken and then prepared it at home, for example, if you go and you just say you just buy a package of chicken tenders, that those chicken tenders have been exposed to so much more bacteria, because they may come from different chickens. They've been, prepared on site where other things may have contaminated them. So, I mean, that to me that seems a very clear cause of our increased number of outbreaks.
And we move along to Paul. He's in Pompano Beach. Hey there.
Hello.
Paul. Hi, Paul.
I am asking about the nutrients that are usually found in fresh food. In these combat-ready meals, are they fortified with the nutrients usually found in such foods, or are they supplied separately?
You're asking if I heard that you about nutrients being fortified, and maybe you could repeat Paul's question.
What I'm asking is this. In fresh food, you have nutrients, you have your vitamins and you have your minerals. In these combat-ready meals, are those meals fortified with those nutrients, those minerals and vitamins, or are they supplied to the servicemen and women separately?
I think I understand your question. Are you asking, are combat rations fortified with nutrients?
Right.
Yes, they are. And in fact, one of the things that I have in the a final chapter of the book are on some of the new things coming out of the Natick Center. And one of the things they've done is to do a tremendous lot of research on food supplements and fortification. And they in fact add many things to the ration, although they've concluded, I would say overall, that the oldies but goodies are the best. So those are vitamins and protein, sometimes some glucose, caffeine, etc.
Now, of course, powdered milk and evaporated milk have been around forever. But when I go to my supermarket and go to the dairy department, are there new influences as far as dairy products?
In the dairy section, well, the one that I know of in the actual dairy that is relatively recent is powdered lactose-free milk. There's also one thing that I didn't do too much research on, but I know the military has a great amount of involvement, has been in some of the egg products that are out there, the shelf-stable egg products. And I wouldn't be surprised if, for example, that those egg white mix containers of egg whites and so forth have had a military influence, because it was interested in maintaining stability of eggs. And by the way, that's actually a really hard question from a food science perspective, and it's been hard to get that to be tasty.
To your knowledge, has anyone ever written about this before to any great extent?
I can tell you with almost total certainty that no, because I looked, you know, I said I would have loved to have had somebody to refer to, and sometimes right. I had to read a lot of different sources and piece things together because there is no one source for this.
Where does the USDA come in to all this? Does the military just work with them directly?
Well, the USDA, yes, it's been a collaborator and a partner over time. It worked with the military in World War II, and there are, you know, sometimes, I think with not only the USDA, but with the FDA, they are sometimes projects that they undertake together, and that continues to this day. I think the FDA, for example, is working with the Army on some issues around nanotechnology and bioengineering.
Do they pack some of these meals with MSG to really have kind of a wow flavor factor? I ask this because I've known kids who much prefer that awful Kraft boxed macaroni and cheese to freshly made with three cheeses and freshly baked with a with crouton toppings and everything. They'd rather have that old Kraft stuff.
Tell me about it. That was one of the struggles I had with my kids. They always wanted the boxed mac and cheese, even if I made the homemade. And you're right, they probably do add some MSG, which is, I don't have all the facts at my fingertips, but I believe that the first U.S. manufacturer of MSG had worked in this special Army food lab during World War II and then went off to begin a company in California.
So in your chapter, Unpacking Your Child's Lunchbox, one of your realizations, after realizing that everything you put in the lunchbox was not very good and you were thinking it was so much better than the school lunch, have you decided to give your children the school lunches now, or are you still packing their lunches?
Well, my children are older, so they have their own ideas
about
this now. But I will say that the book has influenced the way I feed my family, in that I started out with a full, you know, I think I mentioned this in the beginning. I love to cook. I'm very food conscious, and I was a leader in the Boston Slow Food chapter for a while. And so I went into this knowing full well that processed foods have a lot of salt, sugar, and fat. One of the things I did discover is that salt and sugar may be there for preservative reasons as much as for taste. In writing the book, that, you know, that processed foods have a lot of chemical additives, you know, flavors and preservatives. But what writing the book made me realize that I hadn't understood before, which is so much of the processed food itself is really just a system for preservation and stability of the ingredients. And a lot of times that system includes things that really aren't foods at all. You know, these fillers and stabilizers and emulsifiers, some of them have a food origin, some of them do not. They were invented in labs fairly recently. So that has made me take an even firmer stance against these foods. And I go to the supermarket and my kids put energy bars in, and I take them out. I say, Army food, no.
Right. Unless you're in special ops. Right.
Yeah.
So, well, we want to thank Anastasia Marx de Salcedo. She's a food writer whose work has appeared in the Atlantic, Salon, the Boston Globe, among other publications, and a regular contributor to NPR's Public Radio Kitchen. And her book is Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. Thanks so much, Anastasia.
Thanks so much for having me.
It was our pleasure.
And bon appetit.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that wraps up the hour. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Check out his work at the Topical Currents Facebook page for links, photos, and discussion. Also, more information plus free audio archives and downloads of our programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Bonnie and I return Thursday with Linda Gassenheimer and wine columnist Fred Tasker for one of our popular restaurant roundabouts with a panel of experts. You can hear about the best South Florida restaurants as well as phone in with your most delectable picks. That's the Restaurant Roundabout with Linda Gassenheimer, Thursday at 1. Thanks for listening. This is Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, here and now, next from NPR News.